Do you have a thumb drive?
Yeah, I'll get you set up while you talk.
First of all, I'm very, very sorry I'm running so late. I thought if I gave myself 45 minutes to be in the car, would be here to be enough. And I hit the fact that, I guess, the on-ramp 45 and Memorial Drive is closed. And just from there, I went downhill. So I apologize very much. So as Professor Hester said, what I wanted to do today is really kind of frame some of these issues. I think what is helpful is to get a sense of the common law and some of the other statutory remedies that are out there. Get a sense of what all kind of across the field you're looking at when you have one of these events. And my intent is to go through kind of, and truly, if you have a situation like this, and I'll give you a few different examples of ones, and I'm going to walk you through one specific, at least the beginning of a fact pattern that we had on a case in the Passaic River, that'll help you kind of frame, just give you a point of reference, what we're talking about when you have one of these things, all of the different remedies and options that are available to you, and then go through the damage categories that you can seek for the public, what's out there, what's available, whether you're acting for the public or for the individual trustees as well. And then really close by trying to outline a little bit of what is the gap, where do natural resource damages actually come into play, and why they're so important here. So I think the thought process was that this particular conversation would be one to help kind of frame for you, the scope of damages and claims that are out there, the scope of issues that come up when you have a spill like this, and then really kind of set the table, I think, for the rest of the class, but certainly the next coming up meetings where we're going to talk about the foundations of the NRD world, the causes of action, the statutes, and then we've actually got a couple of really great presentations coming up, a couple of leading scientists, and as of yesterday, confirmed a couple of the leading economists in these fields are going to come and talk to you in the next few classes as well. So it's pretty fun. It's going to be nice to have everybody here. So I was going to start off with some pictures, but I don't know if that's my fault for being so.
That's all right. I'll keep monkeying with it. But.
Okay. So. Why don't I do this? What I'll begin with is give you a sense of the background of the Passaic River and the kind of issues that we were facing there, and then we can start talking about causes of action, damages, and impacts that you would see to a public entity, in that case, in the state of New Jersey. So a lot of these cases that we're going to be talking about in this class in general, either there's really kind of two very different sources of contamination. One is going to be more legacy, historical contamination that has been caused over decades, right? You've got, whether it be in the Mountain West, you got a lot of cases that are all mining sites. The mining sites had mine tailings and waste that was very acidic, usually because of the ore that they were extracting. The tailings would have the pH of 1 or 2. And I'm talking about just very, very acidic water. It created basically moonscapes in some areas. All vegetation was killed, all fish were killed, the birds. There's a mine site in the Clark Fork River Basin in Montana that we are working on for Union Pacific. They strip mined copper out forever. It created this massive hole called the Berkeley Pit. It filled back up with water. The Berkeley Pit maybe is, I don't know, got a pH of 3, but when, during migratory seasons, when birds land there, they die. I mean, it's just a huge sink at this point. So that's a legacy site. You have historical contamination. Just like in some of these urban rivers, you've got sites like the Passaic that were caused by decades of pollution. It got centuries of urban development. The Passaic was interesting because it was basically the situs of the American Industrial Revolution. A lot of the old mills and tanneries and some of this first stuff that was built as part of the American Industrial Revolution, including Alexander Hamilton's mills at the Passaic Falls, were sited on the Passaic River. And so for literally over a century, that river was the site of massive amounts of industrial development and massive amounts of contamination. And it was historic in terms of just how bad it was. The other end of the spectrum you have is the big oil spills and the big catastrophic event. And we'll talk about it in a little bit. Oil spills are different. Oil spills are different for a few reasons. Most notably, because the law is different. And one of the things that we'll get into a little bit throughout the course of this class is the Oil Pollution Act as distinguished from CERCLA. As Tom Campbell mentioned the other day, following the wake of the Exxon Valdez, there was a kind of a hue and cry about just how bad this was and the fact that a lot of the residents there didn't have a remedy. So imagine you're a fisherman, whether it be commercial, let's say it's a commercial fisherman that lived on Prince William Sound. You have this massive oil spill, and that not only, obviously, you know, tar balls are everywhere, you've got this massive impact to the ecology, but it's killed off basically the fish population, and or substantially impaired it, and there were thousands of people that lived there who depended on that commercial fishing industry in order to make their living, their livelihood. And those entire populations of fish were wiped out, those businesses were wiped out, all of the other businesses that were in place to, you know, the restaurants, the service industry, everybody else that was there for that commercial fishing industry was also wiped out or substantially impaired. And then what you began to see was this weird and rather unfortunate situation where the social services that were called upon for the government services went through the roof. The fishermen who were unemployed and their families, you know, needed more government assistance. You had situations where, frankly, there was a rise in alcoholism and family and spousal abuse. And so social services, you know, were also strained as a result of an incident like that. And the governments, the local governments, who were tax authorities, who were, you know, getting income on those kinds of issues, they were also lost their tax base and they were no longer, thank
you. That was so amazing. Sorry about that.
Able to get their tax bases included, and they lost all their income. The law historically, and this is in here somewhere, there was set up such that in order for an entity to recover those kinds of economic damages, there had to be a direct impact to something you own. If you're an individual, you don't get to claim lost income as a result of an oil spill or property damage unless your property's actually damaged by oil. There had to be physical impact. It was called the Robbins Dry Dock Doctrine. But it had always been, basically, it was kind of a proximate causation issue. And a lot of these issues that we're going to talk about deal with proximate cause and what's foreseeable and what's not. But as a result of that economy in Prince William Sound and the people being so injured by that, the Oil Pollution Act was created as this kind of grand compromise. And it basically said, look, we're going to create a fund. That we're going to tax oil on the barrel, we're going to create this fund, and it's going to be there in the case of a spill and to help the people who are impacted in these economies. And as long as you aren't grossly negligent and you're following the regulations, you as a party who causes an oil spill are responsible, you have a cap. I think it was originally $50 million, it went up in time to $75 million. So worst case scenario, if you have a spill, you're only going to get tagged for $50 to $75 million, and we'll go to the fund beyond that. And that was the kind of the grand bargain that was struck for oil spills. BP quickly waived the cap. They were found grossly negligent ultimately anyway, but they had violated, there were so many safety violations and violations at the Deepwater Horizon at the Macondo rig that they weren't going to litigate it. But I mean, they're in another situation, in another circumstance. That cap would have been in place. Let me see where I am in this. So I thought it would be helpful at least to give you a point of reference to some of these things before I kind of dive into the causes of action and the damages that you're going to be looking at. This is a picture of the Clark Fork River in Montana. This is one of the outfalls of that copper mine that I was referring to. Butte, Montana was called the richest hill on earth. And it was. I mean, it was massive amounts of copper that was mined there. it still looks like this today. This is actually the country's largest Superfund site in terms of acreage. I think it's like 300 square miles, and it's actually four separate Superfund sites that are all together. We've been working on this site for a decade, and it's still got a huge way to go. This is Portland Harbor, the Willamette River. This is a site, as I was talking about, it's an old industrial. A lot of this came from World War II era, Portland-class ships. There was a huge amount of shipbuilding. There's a lot of war effort that went there. And we deal, as Professor Hester has, day in, day out. And we actually spoke with a potential new client yesterday, a governmental entity that they're dealing with World War II era waste that is still there, still never been cleaned up. And it's unfortunate, but a lot of the stuff that was generated during the war effort, World War II, is still out there and still a big problem. This is just a couple images from the Exxon Valdez. It went, you know, obviously from sea otters to fish to this was a gray whale. I think that's actually the Houston Ship Channel and off the tributary of Greens Bayou. This is Galveston Bay. Yeah, that was the Houston Ship Channel. Galveston Bay actually had the case that where I first worked with Tom. It would have ranked. It could have been Superfund. We kept it from doing that. The Port of Houston preferred to not rank it, and we basically handled it as a private litigant rather than sending it to Superfund. But you guys also may be aware of the San Jacinto waste pit site as well. We have there was basically a small island in the middle of the San Jacinto River that about a decade, a little bit more, a couple of paper companies were sending their waste to an old disposal facility that had dug these big trenches and pits and was burying everything in this island. Well, unfortunately, as we know in Houston, anybody who lives here very long, we have subsidence problems. And that island basically went underneath the San Jacinto River. And all the paper waste is one of the primary sources of dioxin contamination. The other major source that we're going to talk about in a second is Agent Orange and a lot of defoliants. But it's interesting because for 20 years, we were looking around Galveston Bay trying to figure out what was the source of the dioxin contamination. Nobody could figure it out. They actually put into place, it's called a TMDL, Total Maximum Daily Load. Is that the right acronym?
Yeah.
You use acronyms so much you forget what they mean. They were searching for the sources of dioxin. Where is it coming from? And going up and down the ship channel in every industry because it just didn't make sense. There was all this dioxin in the Houston Ship Channel and in Galveston Bay and in the fish. And I guess it was about 2007 that somebody figured out that there are these waste pits that existed on this island that no longer exists, that's now submerged in the San Jacinto River. So it's now a Superfund site, and there's a huge fight going on if people haven't seen as to how to clean it up and things of that nature. But the natural resource damages piece, as we've talked about, will be the thing yet to come.
Can I add a small postscript to that?
Yeah, please.
I was on the advisory group for that TMDL, and there's a small and little known piece of information related to it, which is going to stir up litigation by me mentioning it. There was a wedge of dioxin contamination that we could not figure out where it was coming from. Went back and forth and back and forth, and you're right, the San Jacinto River pits popped up and it was like Shazam. It only covers about half the wedge. So we're still looking for the other half. So those of you who are graduating looking for things to do later in your career, there's lots to do still.
Let me know if you can find it. And things like that are interesting just because it's you know the contamination is there, you can see it, it's impacting the fish in a real way. And certainly anything that's kind of a bottom feeder that is really impacted. Then you've got incidents, obviously, like the Macondo, the Deepwater Horizon. I mean, the size and scope of this oil spill was just unheard of. And we were fortunate to work with the state of Louisiana on that one. In that case, most of my work personally was actually overseeing a team of experts at LSU and others to try to quantify the economic damages to the state. And as I'm going to talk about in a minute, you know, in all these things you're looking at, you really have to consider across the board the impacts of things like this. We also worked on the natural resource damages, which were huge as well, and especially in Louisiana.
Spills like that are just, they're massive. Obviously, the Pelicans became kind of the endemic image, indelible image of the Gulf spill.
And by the way, for those of you who would like to, it's now, the PowerPoint's now posted to the website. So if you want to download a note on it in your computers, you can.
The case that we're working on a lot right now is the Gold King mine spill. This was a year ago, August 5th. EPA and contractors, which makes it a very unusual situation because EPA actually caused the release, drilled into a mine at it, understanding for the most part that that had been impounding all of this water and released 3 million gallons of contaminated wastewater that left the Animas River is, you know, basically yellow all the way down to the San Juan River, and then it flowed into Lake Powell. The data from Lake Powell indicates that for about 10 years, heavy metals have been flowing out of that mining district and making their way into Lake Powell. So there's now a shoaling of heavy metals, and we will be looking at the impact of what that's going to be. One of the classes, actually, as we talk about things as we evolve, some of these sites, like Deepwater Horizon and the Gold King, are interesting because they are multi-jurisdictional, not just, they don't just have the feds and a state and a tribe maybe. Here, you know, you've got, you know, 4 or 5 different entities involved. We represent the state of New Mexico. Utah will be involved. The Navajo have just joined our lawsuit. The Southern Ute are impacted. Colorado's there. So you have these multi-jurisdictional trustee councils where the natural resource trustees have to come together and try to work it out. And like in the Gulf spill, you know, there was no question that at least my client, the state of Louisiana, was absolutely positively certain that the overwhelming majority of injury was in Louisiana, and it frankly was. But you know, all the states, all the trustees want to get compensated and want to be able to put programs and projects in their state as well. So there's a lot of interesting backlog and politics along those issues. So in terms of, you know, in litigation and environmental issues, these kinds of cases, they are incredibly complex. The litigation that you're dealing with is remarkably complex. As Amanda and Tom said the other day, most of these cases don't go to litigation, and we certainly resolve more out of court than we do in court. But one of the main reasons is the complexity of them. And the expert issues in terms of admissibility and things of that nature, it's so difficult. And just, I mean, kind of off the top of my head, putting together some thoughts, it's like the kinds of experts that you need on a case like this include things like setting the cleanup levels. As I suspect most of you know, most of our laws are set up to, the cleanup standards are based on risk-based cleanup, that is, you know, whether it causes a human risk or a risk to the environment. You're trying to clean up to a level that science tells you there's not an unacceptable risk going forward. There may be some risk, but it's, you know, acceptable. And they base it on, you know, how often people are eating fish or how often people are exposed. Is it a residential setting? Is it an industrial setting? Things of that nature. But, you know, in a big complex site, that kind of work in terms of establishing what's the proper cleanup level is always done, and it's litigated. I mean, right now in the Gold King mine, we're fighting with EPA because EPA has set cleanup standards that are risk-based standards that are 20,000 ppm for lead. Based on, they said, well, the only people that are going to be exposed to lead in the Gold King or in the Animas River are rafting. These are people that will be exposed for a couple days a month in a raft. They're recreational users. The state of New Mexico is taking the position that we have hundreds of residents who live on this river. This is their backyard. This is a residential standard, not a recreational standard, which means that we should be cleaning it up to 400, not 20,000. So those kinds of things, it's just an expert fight. When we get into, especially when you get into some of these sites that involve big rivers and multiple sources, you're looking at the chemical processes that different plants might have used, the volumes they discharged, the loading of chemicals that went into a water body, trying to fingerprint. One of the things in the Passaic River case was, you know, or frankly, what, you know, Tracy just mentioned with Galveston Bay, fingerprinting the source of dioxin. Where did it come from? A lot of the chemical processes and the plants, the way they make their product allows you to do that. And if you can fingerprint it to a particular source, it helps a great deal, obviously. You need to be looking at which chemicals of concern, I'm going to try to avoid the acronyms as much as I can, but which chemicals of concern are driving risk. You know, I may have a site that's got a whole bunch of chemicals in it, but it's the dioxin that really is causing the risk versus maybe their mercury's low or whatever. You need to be able to focus on those kinds of things. The fate and transport of the chemicals once it gets into the river, the data in terms of where the sediments are, where they're contaminated, and on and on. I mean, these are all issues that you got to have science behind before you ever get to the natural resource damages. And the natural resource damages, and I think one of the things that you should remember as we go through this class is it's damages, it's injury, it's not risk. So when I'm talking about a cleanup and I say, well, I want to clean up the dioxin to a level that isn't going to cause an unreasonable risk to human health or the environment, it's prospective. I've got science that says this amount of dioxin in your fish 3 times a week will cause an injury. And so I'm really just, all I'm doing is back calculating to a number that says that's an unacceptable risk and that's it. It's very different to say this dioxin caused that injury. It's epidemiology, it's actually causation. And it's a much different thing and it's a much more difficult thing to actually show that a particular contaminant caused an injury. And, personal injury, they go through it all the time with respect to what chemical caused a particular injury, that cancer that person has was caused by exposure to that particular chemical. And it's a different kind of science, and it's a more difficult kind of math to actually demonstrate that causation factor rather than the risk factor. So when you get to natural resource damages, you are talking about damage to the resource. It's funny because there actually is, as Amanda said the other day, a lot of this is new. There's not as much proven law on these issues, and there's not as many cases that have gone to appeal where you have really thorough analysis of the expert work and the like. But it's does the injury have to be to a fish, or am I talking about population level injuries? Do I need to say that it was a fish kill of some magnitude? Those kinds of issues, frankly, are litigated all the time. And then the interim loss to services is a big piece of this, and we'll get into it later as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through just a kind of a fact pattern, almost a worst case scenario tort case exam. And then I want to just kind of open it up, and I want to talk about what you see in terms of where are the injuries here and where are the damages. And then we can talk about causes of action and where things might fall short. And see what you think. So, as I mentioned earlier, this is a case that we'll talk about the actual litigation of it later. But I spent 10 years working on this case, so it's ingrained in my brain in a way that a few things ever will be. Cory Booker famously called it New Jersey's biggest crime scene, and it frankly is, it's tragic what went on here. So the Passaic River runs from the Dundee Dam, 17 miles down to Newark Bay. As I said earlier, this is the situs of the American Industrial Revolution. From Alexander Hamilton's mills on, this is a river that was used by society, used by the state, used by the United States as basically a sewage system for all of the heavy industry that was developing in Jersey at that time. The thing that history will show, and frankly, all the data shows at this point, that made the Passaic River different than a lot of other industrialized waterways was this little facility that sits on a 3-acre tract of land. And it was the old Diamond Alkali facility, and this facility was a pesticide facility. For about 20 years, it manufactured DDT and some other earlier pesticides. Those facilities actually were moved to Houston, which is how I ended up working on this case. They moved their DDT operations to Greens Bayou, and we had that case for the Port of Houston when New Jersey then went out to look for counsel on this particular site. This site was retrofitted after they moved their DDT operations to Houston, and it made Agent Orange, which was a 50-50 mix of two different chemicals, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. and put together, that during the Vietnam War era, there was a lot of work being done to try to figure out defoliants. They wanted to, you know, figure out herbicides and defoliants. And so if you ever, you know, studied this era of history, there was Agent Pink, there was Agent Blue, there was Agent Green, there was Agent Orange. Agent Orange was the one that was most effective, and it's the one that became rather widely used and widely known. The problem was that one of the components, the 2,4-D component, had a byproduct that when it was, especially when it was cooked at higher temperatures, it kicked off a particular type of dioxin. This particular type of dioxin, which is called 2,3,7-8-TCDD, is considered to be the most toxic synthetic substance known to man. It's when they have a toxicity equivalency analysis, they look at, you know, how different chemicals might be toxic as compared to one another. This dioxin was one, and everything else was graded against it. And for 20 years, this plant dumped ungodly quantities of this chemical into the river on purpose. Anything that was off spec, anything that they didn't want to discharge, their waste was so acidic it would burn up the city sewage lines. So they had secret conduits to the river. This wasn't like, oh, it was made at a time when people didn't know. It was illegal. They knew it was illegal. The sewage systems, you know, had regs in place. They were supposed to discharge to a system, and they basically bypassed it because their waste was so acidic. It was so bad that it created a, literally during the DDT era, a mountain in the Passaic River. They called it the Colker Island, but it was basically, that was the name of the company originally. There was so much DDT waste that was coming out as a solid, they would send their workers out at night with the pickaxe to chop it up. This one poor guy who was deposed, he didn't know how to swim. They tied a rope on him, and they shoved him out in the river to get him to chop it up. In 1983, the United States government figures out that Agent Orange is the source of this particular dioxin. There's a site in Times Beach, Missouri, where they figure out that all the livestock are dying, and they can't figure out why, and they tie it back to this particular process. So a notice goes out nationwide saying you've got to look for these sites. And by the time they found this particular site in 83, the entirety of the area was contaminated. The site is located basically right about here on this map. This is Newark Airport. This is the port of New York in New Jersey. The dam is off map, but by the time they discovered it, this area right here, which is from this Raymond Avenue this way, is called the Iron Bound. It's basically ringed by railroad tracks and a lot of heavy industry in there, and this very poor Portuguese community that lives there. And the entirety of the area is just wickedly contaminated with dioxins through air emissions. And so they actually clean the sewers and the streets of Newark, they bring it all back on site, and they don't know what to do with it. It was 400 boxcars, railroad boxcars, full of material, and they didn't want to take it off site, they didn't want to incinerate it there, so they actually built a kind of a tomb for it, and they've entombed it there, and it still sits there today, exactly as it was. That's technically an interim remedy, though the responsible parties keep referring to it as a permanent remedy. They don't want to ever have to open that thing up, understandably so.
Actually, Bill, before you leave that picture, do you mind? And by the way, I should let you know, I'm controlling myself because I've also worked on this site, and there's so much history.
It's crazy.
This is a movie script waiting to be written, and if you ever find yourself with the opportunity, I don't think you want John Travolta playing you, but
it's tragic.
But for those of you who work or go up to New York City, if you take the Amtrak line, it actually is on the other side of the Passaic River from this site. So you will actually see it as you go by.
Yeah.
It's like this concrete mound. But
it's nuts.
What I thought was a nice touch detail. But if you look at that picture, you see at the top that line of dots?
It's right here.
Can you guess what those are? Landscaping. They're a series of trees in pots that are designed to essentially give it a bit more of a natural look as the ships and the trains go by.
It's the craziest thing you've ever seen.
And there it sits. They basically right now are trying to figure out what to do, but the default plan seems to be in perpetuity. I hate to say, until they figure it out.
For the upland remedy? Yeah.
What am I looking at? Is your 18-wheeler trailers on the right, or is Did they dump concrete over the whole?
So yeah, so the entirety, this, they actually bought, this was the original 3-acre tract, they bought the land next to it. So this is actually now 8 acres. And what you're seeing here is these are basically box cars.
Right.
Intermodal cars, and they've actually, I guess they had put, at this time this photograph was taken, there were some up there as well. This was taken during the time they were doing what they called an emergency or interim dredge. This area right here along the waterfront was like the hottest of the hot contamination. So this is the only thing that's actually had any kind of remedy whatsoever. But this is basically a concrete mound that has been placed over 400 boxcars filled with dioxin material.
Okay, so the boxcars are under there.
Yeah, and they have, and it's funny because I have these really great historical photos of this stuff when they were bringing it all back. There was a fruit market and a vegetable market that was right here. Again, yeah. this is a really amazingly poor community. And the argument had been since the 80s, since they discovered, well, nobody would fish in this water. Well, none of these people would. And the Ironbound, the Portuguese, they actually were. One of the things that actually, when we were first hired, it was amazing, the EPA took the position that this was a Superfund site at the very outset. And as soon as it was discovered, it's listed. And it started with the upland site, and then they moved out into the river, and they said they designated originally the lower 7 miles of the Passaic, and then it went to 17, and then it went to the entirety of Newark Bay. Ultimately, all of this that you see was designated as a Superfund site. All of Newark Bay, the lower reaches of the Hackensack River, the Arthur Kill and the Kilvan Coal, as well as 17 miles of the Passaic, are all now part of the Superfund site, all because of the dioxin. So when we representing the state of New Jersey, first went out and said, we basically announced two things. We're going to, we issued a directive to the people who owned the plant, who through corporate reorganizations and transactions became Occidental Chemical and Maxis Energy. We said, look, we're gonna create, issue a directive that says, you guys have gotta figure out how to clean this stuff up. Because the EPA has sat on this for 25 years, all this study, nothing's happened. And we also filed a lawsuit seeking damages, and we'll talk about that in a second. The EPA originally opposed it. It was surprising. They basically said this is going to be inconsistent with our process and our remedy, and you know we really don't want the state of New Jersey involved in this. What was shocking was we had been doing FOIA requests on EPA's records and going through them. Their internal documents indicated that EPA had calculated, this is staggering, if you do this work, this is the worst thing I've ever heard of. One blue crab out of Newark Bay consumed every 25 years would double your cancer risk. I mean, EPA figured that one crab would double your cancer risk every 25 years. It was nutty. So when we attached that to the letter back to EPA saying, how in the world could you oppose us after 25 years, you've done nothing, here's what you've said. They actually changed their mind. It took a long time, but EPA actually has issued a remedy. It's about a $1.5 billion cleanup, and that's probably light by most estimations. It's probably going to cost a lot more than that once it's actually implemented. And I'll talk about all those, you know, fun details in another class later, and the fight that continues among the responsible parties, including Professor Hester's old client. But the dioxin drove the cleanup, and these, you have these mud flats that were filled with this contamination. It was just crazy. So from the state of New Jersey's perspective, you know, we get this you've got this 17 mile waterway that feeds into the Port of New York in New Jersey, which is a bi-state entity. It's very unusual, but it's basically two state governments that each fund a big chunk of this. And you've got just massive decades of problems as a public entity. And so what you're looking at is, you know, what are the costs and the damages that an entity like the state of New Jersey would have? And so some of the, you know, take the private parties out of this. And there was litigation early on. The workers at the Agent Orange facility, they filed their claims. There were personal injury type allegations, medical monitoring, things of that nature. But the state was faced with massive problems as a result of this. And some of the things that we went through, but I want you to also kind of give me some sense of what you might think. Obviously, response and remediation costs. The cost to clean it up and investigate it were massive, as it turned out. The state had spent a huge amount of money just to investigate pieces of this before we ever even got involved. So one of the things that's interesting is the states, like every state in the union, owns the submerged lands under these waterways. There are some unique situations where it's a little bit different, but imagine you're the state of New Jersey and you own the land underneath the Passaic River. Anybody have any ideas of what damages and what kind of issues that might cause if the state owns that land, that submerged land? I'll give you a few hints. One is, you're the property owner, right? I mean, just like if you own any tract of land, you own the real property. So your land has been contaminated by somebody else's stuff. Submerged land doesn't have a market value like a regular piece of land because it can't be bought and sold. It's held in trust for the benefit of the public. But in this instance, the state actually has to serve as the local sponsor. This is a navigable waterway. Congress has said that the Passaic River should be maintained to a depth of 35 feet and should be navigable. So one of the things that we looked at first was, well, you know, what happened after they found the contamination? Never been dredged again. The moment that 1983 they said there's contaminant, dioxin contamination in all the sediment, the Army Corps of Engineers said, we aren't dredging this channel any longer. We will not maintain it because if we do, basically, if we move this stuff around and we dredge it, it's going to create more contamination. It will spread in the waterway. And so as a result, what you end up with is if the river kind of goes like this out to Newark Bay, and through here, it was authorized to 35 feet. This is 4 miles. And the Corps stops dredging, and they won't maintain the channel any longer. All of the facilities, all of these big plants, and Hercules had a big facility, and it was hundreds of them ultimately. But they get silted in. If they're not dredging the waterway, then they can't get their product out and their materials in by water any longer. This goes out into Newark Bay, and then Hackensack is over here. So you end up with all these shuttered facilities along the Passaic River, and unfortunately, that same train ride, they're still there. A lot of them, and it still sits there. So when we were going through EPA's files, we found all these letters from the 80s, 89, Celanese and others saying, you've got to come dredge this. You need to take care of this, or we're going to lose our business. Yeah.
What happens from potential citizen suits, and is that endangered species in that area, or even on the flip side, when we're talking about the water or the land is held in trust for the citizens of the state of New Jersey, cannot a citizen suit be brought to clean it up?
So a citizen suit, a statutory suit like under the Clean Water Act or RCRA, is usually preempted when the state or the feds are actually taking action. So you're looking for a gap in what's
taking,
not happening.
Are they taking action if they're doing nothing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the answer is yes. If it's listed and they're studying it and the like. What's interesting is that in Newark Bay, so one of the big claims that came out of this, so if this is Newark Bay and you've got the Port of New York and New Jersey, there's two big berths there, and then the port picks up on the side as well. In here, you've got this navigation channel that runs all the way through and out of Newark Bay. It also has to be dredged and maintained all the time. And I'll go back to that picture. In the middle of the bay. So this is, massive port facilities here, massive port facilities there. The channel, ran like this through here, and then it goes out to the Atlantic Ocean or over into the Hudson River that way. The Statue of Liberty is right there for your point of reference. So this is dredged all the time. The maintenance dredging to keep it clean. And that ended up being one of our damage numbers, frankly, is that the state of New Jersey, the way that these things work is the Army Corps of Engineers actually does the dredging, but the state or the local sponsor of the port actually has to pay to put it someplace. You've got to provide a spot. So it used to all go out into the Atlantic Ocean, into open water disposal. When they found all the dioxin, they said you can't go there anymore. You can't put it out. And so the state started having to specially treat and dispose of this stuff. And the price went from $5 a cubic yard to $85 a cubic yard hundreds of millions of dollars of expense and exposure. The reason that they had to quit going out into the open water with that was a citizen suit. The Baykeeper and Rutgers University sued the Army Corps of Engineers and said, you can't keep dumping all this dioxin contaminated material out into the open water.
Is there any possible way now that with essentially a suit, the global warming type of suit, where we all have much more severe weather, as you see from Superstorm Sandy and the others, and you know that these dioxins are going to be pushed around by the tides flowing and excessive tides like that, is there any way to force more of the cleanup there, even though you got preemption, or even though you said that the state and the feds are taking action so nothing can be done, could it be forced that way?
I don't think so. I think that, there is a ton that's arguably going to be changed because of global warming concerns and climate change. Those factors would go into whatever remedial decisions are being made at any given point in time, but it's going to be baked into the cleanup rather than a new cause of action. But the navigational issues and those kinds of costs absolutely end up being a big piece of these things. Again, a damage, when you imagine all of these businesses have gone away, is also to the state's economy. You've lost jobs, you've got this kind of economic blight. You've got an area that was productive and now it is not. The flip side of that is also true, that when you create this kind of dead zone, property values go to nothing, your tax base is dropped precipitously, and what's interesting in most jurisdictions, property taxes are a function of local governments. Counties and cities collect property taxes. But if there is not enough property tax receipt to cover a locality, Newark, the state ends up backfilling it. And the state of New Jersey ended up pouring in tens of millions of dollars of extra cost to cover schools, basic services, because the tax base was destroyed as well. These are kinds of damages that are dealt with by the state as an actor, right? These are damages that go to the public entity. And those are distinct from, and I'm going to pick up the pace, but they're distinct from the damages that the state can collect as a trustee for the public. And it's the latter category of damages that the natural resource damage components really fill. It's the economic damages that are really to the state as the actor, that there's a lot more in the root of our laws than people think. And that's the interesting thing, is a lot of times when you look at these cases, people don't think about some of these issues that go to the public, to the state, as a damage directly to the state that our laws actually do allow for. And as I said, with the port impacts in particular, you really have to think about the intersection of the economy and the environment. The ports are creating the jobs, they're creating the industry, they've got a tax base, there's growth there, and so the contamination really hits them directly. I'm going to run through these kind of quickly. When you run into one of these bigger sites, what I'd like to do is go through these different types of causes of action so I can get into the NRD quickly here at the end. First and foremost, is, as I said, is the cleanup costs and the remediation. You've got statutory constructs like CERCLA, which governs chemicals of concern, hazardous substances other than oil. The Oil Pollution Act deals specifically with hydrocarbons and oil. And then RCRA is another statute that deals with the same set of suite of hazardous substances, but it's prospective. It's trying to force a cleanup. It's like the codification of a public nuisance. So those are the main vehicles by which you can seek to require somebody to clean up their mess, basically, or seek compensation for the funds that you have expended. And I don't know how many folks have had some of the basics on the environmental laws or not, but is this all ringing true? Do people kind of remember this, these constructs and these statutes? Okay. These are easier claims. They're not easy. I mean, as Professor Hester knows, these are not easy things. Oftentimes, there's a huge amount to fight about, again, because a lot of these environmental cases are massive. But as compared to the natural resource pieces of it, some of this stuff is pretty simple. A lot of the main issues will fall around joint several liability. For 30 years, everybody thought CERCLA was jointly and severally liable, period. In a case that kind of surprised a lot of us, the Supreme Court a few years ago in Burlington Northern Santa Fe said, no, it's not. Statute didn't say joint and several liability, so it's only joint and several unless, or if you can't show divisibility of harm. And if you can show divisibility of harm, then you are only responsible for your piece of the contamination and you're not jointly and severally responsible. And that may be something we want to talk about at some point later in this class as well. Everybody thought this was a sea change, the world was going to change, it was going to be, you know, for environmental practitioners, a massive distinction because the Supreme Court had said this divisibility argument actually allows you several liability, not joint and several. I think in published opinions since that case came out, the divisibility arguments are 0-57. I don't believe one has stuck since. So it didn't create the huge difference that folks thought it would. Generally speaking, it's supposed to be polluter pays. It's supposed to be rather straightforward. Other theories of recovery, and these, I want to just kind of plant these notions, and part of the concept here was to talk with you about where the other laws are and where there are gaps and problems. So you've got these state remedies, or the statutory remedies. Obviously, you've got claims like negligence and gross negligence. If it's a Valdez, it's a spill, it's a gross negligence kind of a situation, or other, you know, historical contamination cases as well. You could make those types of cases. Those are harder in the legacy sites. The statute of limitations issues are huge sometimes with traditional tort remedies. It depends on what jurisdiction you're in, but a lot of times traditional tort remedies are great if you can get to them, but they may be time barred or there might be another reason why you can't get to them. Trespass in almost every jurisdiction has there's an intentional notion to it. The trespass is really an intentional tort in many respects. You're looking at the rationale, the reason for doing it, and trespassing on somebody else's property or rights. Putting contamination or chemicals of concern, dioxin, on somebody else's land is absolutely a trespass. The reason it matters is because of that nature. It actually has it may have different remedies. Trespass, for example, in many states has a restitutionary remedy, which means you basically are asking the tortfeasor to disgorge their profits. So rather than say, look, you injured my property and I want you to clean up my property, I'd say, yeah, I'd rather take your profits from 20 years of manufacturing. It's a huge deal if you can get into those kinds of remedies. There are always, you know, per se violations of statutory rules and regs. Public nuisance is an incredibly valuable and viable tool to state governments. Creating a nuisance that impacts the public and the public's right to use the waterways, whether it be in navigational uses or swimming or fishing, if you impair the public's use, there's almost always a public nuisance claim. What's nice about a public nuisance claim is that in almost every instance there is not a limitations issue, and the governmental entity can require abatement of a nuisance, basically remove the nuisance and the nuisance-causing activity. So it's an incredibly powerful tool when you can use it, and you can use it just like RCRA or side-by-side with these statutory remedies. In some jurisdictions, there's strict liability. There's an incredibly little-known cause of action. We've actually used it a couple times called Purposture. It's a common law interference with navigation. It usually requires a physical impairment, but not necessarily. And if you can't dredge because of contamination, that in my mind is functionally the equivalent of a physical impairment. So it came out of basically you're blocking a public easement. If you put a dock across the public waterway, or you blocked a public highway, that was an obstruction or a purposeture, and
I can't resist asking it.
Yeah.
Has anyone argued that that's been displaced or preempted by the Rivers and Harbors Act?
People have argued that it's kind of archaic, but that most jurisdictions in which it exists, it's still viable. It wasn't displaced. If it's it's a navigable waterway, I mean, I suspect you might be able, depending on where you are and what you're dealing with, you might be able to argue some sort of preemption or displacement, but typically, no, it's still alive. It's actually a form of public nuisance. It's just really more to public rights of way. then you've got more, you know, obviously, depending on your circumstances, breach of contract, fraud, things of that nature. But I want to talk to you a little bit more in detail is the public trust doctrine. The public trust doctrine is the foundation for natural resource damages. This doctrine, in many respects, is the foundation for a lot of what you're going to be talking about. And I pulled a couple slides and old quotes from some briefs that we had done on Passaic because it actually underpinned a lot of what we were talking about there and some of the a lot of the legal fight about what we could do under the New Jersey Act. The public trust doctrine, going back to England, the concept was that the king owns the forests and the livestock and the wild and the beasts in the forest and the birds and the deer. It all basically belongs to the king. And as time evolved, that became more, well, the king owns it, but he's holding it in trust for the benefit of the public. And so if a poacher goes out and kills a deer or something like that, that's why the king can enforce it, because the king is enforcing it on behalf of the public's right in all these issues. So as we as a country evolved, and obviously the common law evolved, it was the public trust doctrine that really gave the sovereigns the status to bring the lawsuits or bring the claims for interference with natural resources, whether they be waterways or living creatures. But that was the true underpinning of a lot of these laws. So what's interesting, if you look back in it, again, most of our work has been in these big waterway cases. But the original purpose of the public trust doctrine was to reserve for the use of all the public natural water resources for navigation and commerce, waterways being the principal transportation arteries of early days, and for fishing, an important source of food, going back to 1821. This just is more of the same, but the idea is that that it's been the settled law of the United States that the public trust doctrine in the states are the ones that are basically empowered to bring the claims to protect submerged lands under the waterways, the navigation being so important. New Jersey went so far as to say that because it's a trust and the state holds the lands in trust, it actually doesn't have just the right to bring the claim, it has an affirmative duty to do it, and it has to protect the trust resource for the benefit of the public. So what happened then is this notion of natural resource damages begins to flow from the public trust doctrine. As I mentioned earlier, then came OPA. And the Oil Pollution Act, after the Exxon Valdez, codified a lot of these damages in a way that hadn't been done before. And so what you've got now, especially in the oil field area, is it's not just response costs, it's not just property damages. The statute specifically allows for the recovery of these lost governmental revenues, the cost of additional public services, lost profits and earning capacity, and this is not only for individuals, but for the state. So these tax revenues and things of that nature, as well as subsistence use damages, are all available. So under an oil spill scenario, you really actually have a statute that gives you, you know, truly massive recovery capacity and ability. And the last piece is filling in the natural resource damages in the oil spill category as well. The Deepwater Horizon, as we began to talk about yesterday, really, I think, is going to change the way that OPA is used and the way the natural resource damages are going to be used as well. I do think it's hard to overstate the potential impacts of what that event did, the size and scope of it. The damages it created. It educated a whole new group of experts and lawyers in these state entities as well, but it really pushed the boundaries of what a lot of people thought was going to be acceptable and how these things work. And the natural resource damages, obviously, in Louisiana in particular, you had massive damages to the marshes, injuries to the fish, the bird, the food chain, the entire web. You've got the loss of human uses and the cultural impacts that we talked about. You had practical impacts as well, of course, with long-term impacts on drilling in the Gulf. Folks remember, right before the Deepwater Horizon, President Obama had actually authorized massive blocks of drilling in the Eastern Gulf. The moment the spill happened, all that went off the table, and it will never come back on the table. The Western Gulf was shut down, you know, for 6 to 8 months, of course, during the moratorium. The industry has changed a great deal. But the nature of what is remote and some of these issues around causation may end up being some of the biggest factors that come out of the Deepwater Horizon when you looked at something that was so huge, and take any industry that was impacted, but the seafood industry is one that's kind of obvious as well. When the seafood industry was impacted, and the fishermen, the oystermen in particular, and the shrimpers in the, along Louisiana, they lost their fishing grounds, the oysters were killed, the oyster beds in Louisiana, about 50% of them were destroyed as a result of the spill and the response actions. That ripple effect, not just in the localities that are right on the coast where the oysters that are destroyed, but all of the uses and all of the different industries and people that are actually dependent upon that fishing industry or the packing industry or the restaurants. And a lot of restaurants were claiming, seafood restaurants were filing claims as well. There was a truly very significant departure from the kind of the notion of proximate cause as a result of the Gulf spill. As I said, the governmental losses, they hit every sector. In the settlement, Louisiana received over $1 billion for direct economic damages, and then the natural resource damages ended up being over $10 billion as well across the board. But what is left, and when you move through these different causes of action and the issues that are left, it is the natural resource damage that is the piece that we are going to end up focusing on in the remainder of this class is, once you get the cleanup done, once you get these costs back, once you look at the economic impacts, once you look at the property impacts and all of the other pieces that are left, what you've got to end up doing is valuing the, as we discussed some on Monday, what's the value of the resource? What did you actually lose and how can you restore that? And I think that's the piece that ends up being, it's much more difficult. Frankly, juries, judges, all of us are trained to think in terms of economic values and economic terms. I think that the tax losses and the economic stories ended up being great cases and great leverage sometimes in natural resource damage cases, because it's so difficult to value an oyster bed. So oyster bed is a perfect example of where all these interests intersect as well. The oystermen in Louisiana own the oysters. They actually have a financial interest in harvesting them. They sell them for commercial purposes. That same oyster bed is providing a natural resource service because they filter the water. And so it's a huge service that the public gets from those oyster beds as well. And so it becomes this intersection of different people's interests when they're trying to figure out how to claim and recover for these issues. And what's the public loss of that oyster bed and those resources is usually scientific and difficult. I'm going to close out with just showing you this graph. And again, this is my fault. I'm sorry I was running late. This is helpful, and I think if you want to kind of visualize, being a visual person as well, natural resource damages, this is it. Imagine your baseline condition. Baseline is going to be a word you're going to hear a lot. Baseline is, what did the Gulf of Mexico, pre-Macondo spill, what were all the services that it was providing? All the fish, all the habitat, the dolphin, the tuna, the oysters, the shrimp, the birds that were feeding on them, the recreational uses, the cultural uses. There are all these services that come out of this natural resource. And this, as you put them all together and imagine, that's your baseline condition. That's what life looked like the day before the spill. The day of the spill, you have your release of a hazardous substance. The baseline condition, all those services are deteriorating rapidly because of the oil and the fish kills and the like. You begin a response action to address the cleanup. You have, your response is considered, under the language of these statutes, more the emergency response or removal type actions. You go through this category, you begin your remediation. Your remediation action ends at some point in time. There's this piece left until you get back to baseline, until you get your baseline is restored. And this delta is what we're talking about. This is the damage model. How do you value everything in here and all those services that were lost and all those resources that were injured? That's what we're talking about. So you pay to clean all this stuff up and you get back to here, but this entire delta has not been recovered yet. And those are the public's damages. From the public trust doctrine on, that's what the public has lost. And it's the valuation of that is so difficult. it is, as we talked about, this idea of how do you value the natural resource in terms of the habitat itself. In the Gulf of Mexico, obviously, you're not trying to literally replace the Gulf of Mexico, but you have so many resources, and so many going down to the coral and the sediments and the biota and everything that were in that food web and all the fish that were injured, it created a cascading problem throughout the entirety of the Gulf. It was interesting because, going back to this notion of baseline, you kind of find it as you take it. So Exxon had the worst case scenario with the Prince William Sound because it was genuinely pristine. What BP spent the first couple of years of the litigation arguing was, well, the Gulf of Mexico is already pretty degraded. Coming down out of the Mississippi River, you've got this area that's got very low oxygen. You've got depletion concerns here and there. And frankly, there's the Gulf of Mexico oil seeps up from the bottom of it naturally, and it does. But so there was this huge fight about what's baseline. I will tell you that one of the size and scope of this thing, the science that came out of it is amazing because the trustees had money they would never have otherwise had. And before the oil hit the shores, everybody figured out how bad this was going to be, and NOAA and Department of Interior paid a ton of money to put scientists all along the Gulf of Mexico, getting data as fast as humanly possible, collecting as much information as we could about what oil was already there, what conditions were in place. The marsh in Louisiana, they lost hundreds of square miles of marshland because when the oil would come in, it would basically oil the saltgrass and push the saltgrass down, which would allow erosion, which meant more salt water would go in. And so all this freshwater marsh was just being destroyed at a football field a day. Had we not been able to go out basically with those flat bottom boats and capture where was this in existence before that, we would never have been able to establish baseline. But the fight about baseline it's a massive fight in some of these situations. The Passaic River, how do you prove natural resource damages when a river is the situs of the American Industrial Revolution and they start dumping dioxin in the 60s? The river is so degraded by the time the dioxin came, that's part of their defense. The river was totally ruined before we got there. Again, Exxon had the kind of unfortunate scenario with the Valdez of hitting just truly a pristine environment. But this battle, these are the things that are, from the expert's perspective, the economics, the environmental piece, it's a huge battle. And how to measure these losses, there's no question there is a loss there. But how do you prove it? How do you demonstrate it? How do you quantify it? HIA and RIA and some of the other things that we've talked about, those are ways to get a case settled. Those are things that say, look, I don't want to put it into dollars. I that wetland I lost, I just want another one like it. And that's a way to basically avoid trying to monetize it. But you can't ask for another wetland from a judge and a jury. You actually have to monetize it, which is one of the reasons why these cases don't go to trial. But it's what, as we talked about the other day, it's what makes it fun. It's all evolving. It's really as creative as you can be. And so these other causes of action, other things, they're tools to actually help you make the public whole when you have a spill like this or a situation like this. Cut it off. I apologize.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So from what you've been saying so far, when you want to bring your suits in this area of natural resources damages and restoration, I got so far that it's state court that has jurisdiction. The jurisdiction lies with the state court?
No, it can. It can also lie in the federal courts as well. So the laws, the federal laws basically designate three trustees that can bring, three categories of trustees that can bring these claims. So the federal government can do it. It's Department of Interior and NOAA, which sits in the Department of Commerce. Then the states each are a trustee, and then the tribes are trustees as well. So you can bring a case, a state can bring a case in its own state court, or it can bring a case in the federal court, depending on what the state statutes is. The states also have their own statutes that may allow for these causes of action as well. It just kind of depends state by state.
So the places where these incidents happen decides which state has the jurisdiction?
Yes. Yeah. And in the Passaic River case, we filed it in state court. The defendants removed it to federal court. said everything was preempted because of the New Mexico GE case that Tom was involved in, and we won. This federal court in New Jersey said, no, it's not preempted, and they sent it back to state court. But where the case sits, and those courts is actually often litigated as well.
And I hate to say it, because there's another class at 7:30, so we may have time for one more question, if anyone has any.
Typically, the same attorney or the same firm that goes up and signs these various clients, like you mentioned, that you often get an intersection of like public and private parties that are affected by these events?
I would say no. We represent governmental entities, port authorities, and states, basically. I wouldn't do it. I think it'd be very, very difficult to actually represent private parties as well. Take the oyster. You've got totally competing interests. The oyster man and the oyster the industry, they're selling it as a commercial good. They have economic damages they associated with that. The state is looking at that same resource as a totally different function, and those interests don't usually align.
Is it an actual conflict of interest?
It probably could be, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you can represent both at the same time.
Yeah, it'd be almost impossible. Most states can't even waive a conflict, so it would be almost impossible to do that.
Okay, so with that, thank you for a fantastic presentation.
I
very quickly, before we break, check the website. I'm going to try and post any readings for next week's classes tomorrow. I will also be trying to get the password set up, so let me know if you have any trouble. I'll be glad to try and be your IT guy for the weekend. Other than that, next week on Monday, we will start with NRD 101 with Professors Campbell and Halter. I'll probably offer a quick 10-minute retrospective as well. So, and then we have a fascinating opportunity on Wednesday, where we're scheduled to have Bob Haddad in.
Which is going to be great.
He was the chief ecologist for the Deepwater Horizon spill for the federal government. So he is going to be able to talk with some of the science concepts with you that you're going to need to be able to do the NRD legal work later in the semester. So any last thoughts or questions before you go off to enjoy the weekend? Okay, see y'all on Monday.
Thank you. Again, I'm sorry.
Over the email?
Okay. Yes, and make sure, as long as you're on the sign-up sheet with your, make sure
I'm... Yes, oh, you want the email as well, but I wasn't...
Well, no, as long as I have your name, I can
make sure I'm here. Yeah.
There you are, okay. Yes. Yes, I'll make sure you do that.
Perfect, thank you.
Yeah.